Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Happy New Year and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we're bringing you some of our favorite tourism conversations from over the past year, including how Phoenix became a refuge for tuberculosis patients and unwittingly played a role in the history of ceramics.
And crowds have flocked to Sedona for years, but is it becoming over-touristed?
But first, tourism is big business in Arizona. The State Office of Tourism reports visitor spending was more than $29 billion in direct spending to the state back in 2023. There's no slowdown in sight. But what drew people to this fast-growing, sunny city full of incredible contrasts and natural beauty?
From all over the world, come visitors to relax and rest in the sun-drenched desert of Arizona. Dude ranches, great resort hotels, inns.
Scottsdale is delightful and clean and new.
Phoenix, a simply splendid city. Don't worry for a minute about a place to stay.
There is a ruggedness here, a loveliness here, that combines into a package of colorful memories. History, wildlife, entertainment, grandeur, they're all here awaiting you on your Arizona holiday.
Visitors from the East Coast or Midwest have headed to the Valley looking for something different, or maybe just some sunshine, for decades. In Phoenix's early days, many flocked here looking for health and wellness. Here's a conversation from our last resort series that aired last September. Joining me today is the show's senior producer, Sativa Peterson, who dove into Arizona's historic newspapers and documents to talk about another early draw to the Valley, health and wellness. Good morning, Sativa.
Good morning, Mark.
Hope you're feeling well.
So, I am. Thank you. Yeah, it turns out, you know, health and wellness played a very important role in Phoenix's origins as a resort town. And of course, climate was a key factor in all of this, which we'll get to in just a second. But first, let's do a quick catch up. In this series, we've already mentioned how the construction of the highway system across the United States played an important role in the growing tourism industry in Phoenix.
Right. We learned that by the 1930s, for example, Van Buren Street in Phoenix was at the crossroads for four federal highways, the US 60, 70, 80, and 89.
Yeah, that's correct. So even before that, there was an earlier technological achievement that brought waves of visitors to our state, and that was the arrival of transcontinental train service in Arizona, which began in the late 1870s and early 80s. And it really didn't take long before there were multiple passenger trains a day passing through Phoenix. You had the Southern Pacific, the M&P, which stood for the Maricopa and Phoenix Railroad, and the Santa Fe.
And Sativa, I imagine these early travelers were anticipating getting away from the snow and cold of the East and Midwest and heading somewhere where maybe there was some sunshine.
That was a big part of it. And very early on, we start to see sunshine being equated with health and wellness. I found a pamphlet published in 1899 called Arizona Health Resorts. It was published by the passenger department of the Santa Fe Railroad. And I'm just going to read it to you.
Okay.
It said, quote, "Are your lungs weak? Have you a troublesome cough? If thus afflicted, try the climate cure, which consists of taking up one's residence in a place where the air is dry, pure, and warm. Nature is the best of physicians when conditions are friendly."
Hmm.
Yeah. So weather and good health tied together early on. Now, around the same time as transcontinental rail travel is becoming a reality, tuberculosis was hitting the country very hard. It was the second leading cause of death in the U.S. in 1900. So all across the Midwest and East Coast, you know, hometown doctors are recommending to their patients with lung problems that, hey, maybe you should head to Arizona to recover. And so with that, and because of the rail service, people start to flock to Phoenix as a therapeutic destination.
Well, so there must have been a need for places for all those people to stay. Was Phoenix set up for that?
Well, yeah, we have some examples of that. So some people, if they could afford it, stayed in sanitariums. But these were, you know, could be almost luxurious to some extent. So many people were looking for an alternative to that. And they started wintering at what were rustic health camps in what is now Scottsdale.
Hmm.
One of these was Graves Guest Ranch. This is operating around 1910s. It was located in the northwest corner of Indian School and Scottsdale Roads, and it catered to visitors and folks who would come to the dry Arizona climate to restore their health. And we start seeing mentions of people coming to Arizona in newspapers printed all across the country, you know, from towns in Iowa and Arkansas, North Dakota, Wisconsin. So at the Graves Guest Ranch, people were staying in structures that were pretty simple, really a wood frame that was covered in canvas. And this was also happening in the Sunny Slope area. There were encampments, more people living in tent houses and rudimentary cottages. And there were so many health seekers, in fact, that that's one of the things that helped Arizona reach its population in order to achieve statehood.
Really?
Yeah. So you start seeing people staying at the Graves Guest Ranch. But as you can imagine, people afflicted with, you know, tuberculosis, it was a highly contagious disease. And, you know, to be honest, some of them were not always welcomed here. So I've got an example of how this plays into our resort history.
Well, let's hear that. What is it?
Well, we see our first real luxury resort in the Phoenix area, which is Castle Hot Springs, which opened back in 1896. So this is this long, you know, continuum we're going to see of how health and wellness play into our resorts. But it built itself as a pleasure and a health resort of the highest class, well known for its hot mineral waters and glorious climate. Ads start appearing for Castle Hot Springs Hotel in the Arizona Republican as early as 1906. And there was some interesting language. One ad claimed, quote, "No cases of tuberculosis or other infectious diseases will be received. This is for the safety of the other guests, and because diseases of this class are not benefited by drinking the waters, and are actually injured by taking the baths." So there's this baked-in tension. You know, we even see class mentioned. And so there's almost this assumption that tuberculosis could be contained, you know, and that they could kind of keep it out.
So, Sativa, were you able to find any other examples of health and wellness being used as a draw for people to the Valley?
Yes. Now, stay with me because this is going to be a bit of a hard pivot.
Okay.
So, eventually, you know, the tuberculosis epidemic does come to an end in the late 1940s, and antibiotics are developed, and by the mid-1950s, it's really diminished. So, one of my favorite places is the Main Chance Resort, which opened at the southeast base of Camelback Mountain in 1947. The Main Chance was the second location of the destination spa created by cosmetics and wellness, you know, mogul Elizabeth Arden.
Okay.
She first opened a Main Chance in Mount Vernon, Maine in 1934. And now this location was going to be, you know, a desert location for the wealthy and glamorous where they could winter. And the Main Chance was luxurious. It was ladies only. It offered everything from makeup lessons and manicures to exercise classes and swimming. So this resort promises rest, beauty, weight loss. Most visitors were restricted to a 900 calorie a day diet. So we see this whole trend, this continuation, you know, of people coming to the desert for cures, in a sense.
Well, so Sativa, as visitors continue to increase, obviously so did the number of resorts in the Valley. Spa services are now common amenity along with fitness classes and fine dining. Is there a through line there from what you've been talking about to the kinds of amenities that people come to resorts for now?
I really think so. I think we can draw a line between people coming out, you know, in the 1880s, 1890s for curative treatments, for sun, for health, to even how we see the inclusion of health and wellness treatments at spas today. And it seems like, you know, these ideas around health and wellness were really an essential element of city building here in Phoenix.
Interesting. All right. That is the show's Sativa Peterson. Sativa, thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
One hidden architectural gem from Phoenix's early days that still exists is the Bell Tower, a Pueblo Revival-style building just inside the grounds of the Phoenician Resort. The tower is all that remains of the once legendary Jokaki Inn, which got its start in the 1920s as a tea room. Scott Jarson, a longtime realtor in town who specializes in architecturally unique homes, joined the show last summer to explain what makes the building near 60th Street and Camelback Road so exceptional.
So I have a lifelong interest in unique pieces of architecture and design that are left in the valley, and we're at one of the best of them. This is what's left of the historic Jokaki Inn. This is the Bell Tower, and it's a beautiful adobe structure. It dates from 1936. It was an absolute beacon in the desert that drew people to this resort. It really speaks to why people came here and their first introduction to Arizona and the Sonoran Desert. And if you can imagine the sense of awe of the unique beauty we had here that these visitors got to enjoy. Camelback as a beautiful backdrop and this soaring multi-level adobe structure, it had to be just a point of arrival as you came to start your winter vacation in Arizona. The architect of this was R.T. Evans. He was just known for doing these beautiful Pueblo Revival structures. He did probably 20, 30 structures up and down Camelback. His mother owned this property, and his mother was Jessie Benton Evans. She was an artist. And so you get these artists and architects with these desert dreams, and they realize them. She worked with Mary Coulter at Santa Fe Railroad and Fred Harvey Resorts, so there was that connection. She'd seen this. She understood what it was like to have these destination resorts, and her son realized it in the architecture. This bell tower structure was really important because it anchored this visually for miles. I mean, it was a very ambitious structure, and this is where they would hold tea in the afternoon. It was multi-purpose use, so this became the Jokaki Inn, the symbol for it. It's actually quite modern, so built in the 1930s, it had a conventional foundation, it had good quality windows, but it's multi-level, which is hard to do with adobe. Evans was a master of it. It was locally built. George Ellis was the general contractor. He has rich family ties and built for people like Frank Lloyd Wright. Originally, there were lower adobe structures to the east of the property. They were more like guest casitas. That was the initial start of the inn. There was the Jokaki School for Girls on property. So if you can imagine, this is a place where you might winter and then also have your children educated at the same time. This was a complete destination resort, unlike anything we see today. So at the time, this was probably, well, it was the largest building that you could find in and around Scottsdale. It had to be visible from downtown Scottsdale when the tree canopy was low and the people built lower. So it was so integrated. And if you can imagine Camelback Road, when Camelback was two words, and it's a two-lane road, mostly dirt, and you're coming from the train station in downtown Phoenix all the way out here in the desert. By the time you got out here, you saw this beacon of this tower and went, wow, phew. You would have had Arcadia to the south, all irrigated citrus groves. If you're here in the spring, it's heaven against this desert backdrop. So very special places. And they just spoke of Arizona, the climate and the space. The Jokaki Inn was such a signature detailed building. Evans really understand the nature of these Pueblo structures and how to control how he ornamented them so they weren't over the top. They were very subtle, but it still stands today. We're grateful for it.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, is overcrowding becoming a problem for Sedona?
But first, Phoenix is no stranger to dubious honors. Around 100 years ago, before we were famous for our seemingly endless streaks of 100-degree days or skyrocketing housing costs, the city was known as the last bastion of hope for tuberculosis patients. In the 1930s, scores of people battling the disease flocked to the valley, where the climate was believed to provide relief from TB's debilitating symptoms. Wealthy patients were treated in clinics, but many found refuge in a series of religious missions. The missions couldn't offer much in the way of formal medical procedures, but they did their best to make so-called lungers comfortable, or at least distract them from their illness. One of these missions was in Sunnyslope. Back in October, our co-host Sam Dingman caught up with Ed Dobbins, a Phoenix history buff who says the so-called desert mission also played an unlikely role in the history of ceramics.
The minister who ran the mission, Joseph Hillhouse, he was always out raising funds and finding things for people to do. He didn't want them sitting around all day. And one year he stopped in Hollister, Missouri, and that's where he saw this guy, Harold Herrine, selling pottery along the roadside, the very colorful pottery. And he talked to him and he found out how it was made. And he found out that Herrine was actually would go out to people and sell and teach people how to make the pottery and sell them like a turnkey operation. So Hillhouse thought this would be a good thing for the people in Sunnyslope. And he asked Herrine if he would come out and show him how it's done.
And you say it was this turnkey operation. What was specific about this particular way of making pots?
Well, first of all, it was not made of pottery. It was made out of from cement. But he didn't use any molds. Most pottery would be made out of cement would have been used molds where you break open the two halves. So he patented a process that it was generally built on a wheel, like a potter's wheel, but without the foot pedal. He would start with a pile of wet sawdust covered with cheesecloth and put that on the wheel and then cover that over with a thick layer of concrete and then turn the wheel while he had a template that he would press against the concrete to get rid of the excess concrete to shape the outside of the bowl.
So before we get to the distinctive color element of this pottery, it does seem like one of its benefits is that it was made of incredibly tough
yes,
material.
Yeah, lasts a long time. Yes, it does.
Yeah. But the distinctive quality of it is the color scheme.
Well, most of them are done in a variety of colors, from 1 to 8 or so. Very, very, very brightly colored and in swirls and different patterns. But the way they colored the pottery, he would make his own concrete slip and then grind minerals of different colors into that slip. So when it covered the pot, it would actually form right into the pot. And the raw minerals gave a very bright color.
Interesting. So it's different than some pottery where you're painting the dried pot. It's almost like he was dyeing the concrete.
Yeah, he would apply the different colors while he moved the pot. And he actually had a device for a patent that combined like 4 different colors at once, 2 to 4 different colors. So there's all kinds of combinations based upon the speed that the pot is being turned and the angle that it's being turned at and what combination of colors are being used. So there's a large variety of outcomes.
And the result of this, just speaking qualitatively, is a kind of, the word that comes to mind for me is trippy. It's this kind
yeah,
of trippy, almost
kind of wild-looking pottery.
Yeah, kind of like a psychedelic series of patterns of
right
colors, kind of dripping and bleeding into each other.
Yeah, very nice. You know, the only thing I've read that he gave his inspiration for the colors on the pottery were the paintings of Maxfield Parrish,
like very dreamy, vibrant cloudbursts.
Yeah, kind of a dreamy look to him, and
sort of like a Garden of Eden kind of sensibility. Yeah. So Hillhouse is exposed to this form of pottery that Herrine has literally patented, mm-hmm. it sounds like.
Right.
And he brings it out to Sunnyslope.
And it said that the people really took to it and they made a lot of pottery. They made it from 1935 to about 1939, about
okay.
4 years.
Uh-huh. And if I'm not mistaken, there's kind of an interesting irony here, right? Which is that it turned out that even though the patients started making the pottery as a way to pass the time while they were hopefully recovering from tuberculosis, there was some thought that the process of making the pottery might actually worsen the symptoms, right?
Right, yeah, because of the dust mm-hmm. from the cement.
Right.
And they made it indoors for mm-hmm. the most part.
But so as a result of these various factors, authentic Sunnyslope versions of the pots are particularly rare, right?
I think so, yes, because it's a little hard to tell because I'm pretty sure no one marked them. I only have one that I think might be from Sunny Slope. It has an old piece of masking tape on the bottom, and somebody wrote in Arizona. So it's not, you know, not the best provenance, but it's the best that I've found so far.
Yeah. So how did you come to be interested in this?
Well, I bought a box of these pots from an antique dealer about 7 or 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. And he told me these were made in Sunny Slope during the 1930s. And so naturally I said, how do you know that? He said, well, you know, I found them here in Phoenix. So that I knew I needed a little bit better background than that. And so I started looking into it and found Herein's name. And then I was able to trace him. By 40 years later, was an artist, a painter in Albuquerque.
Okay.
The same name. So I figured maybe as he aged, he moved out here to the Southwest. And I found it. Then I found a research paper from about 20 years later from a scientific lab in Albuquerque about training moths how to detect high explosives. And that seemed like, it seemed a little offbeat, you know, so I thought maybe that had something. And the name Herein, but a different first name, Frank Herein,
okay. Was
one of the authors on that paper.
Uh-huh.
So I decided to contact that Frank Herein and asked him whether his father ever made cement pottery. He said, yes, he did.
So the spirit of experimentation was passed down.
Yeah, right, yeah. So, but he was very happy to find someone finally that was really interested in it and doing some research on it. And we've become friends over here in the past 7 years.
So did Frank have any of the original pots?
He has two, and he gave me one of them, yes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's very nice. Uh-huh. So we know one for sure was made by his father.
Yeah, so that's getting to be almost 100 years old.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah.
90 years, I guess you're right, yeah.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing.
It looks good, too, for 100.
Yeah, well, made out of cement, right? So they just seem like kind of the ultimate Phoenix artwork, you know, because— yeah. It's always extreme circumstances to live out here in the desert.
Right, right.
But then you add the tuberculosis layer.
Right, yes. So, yeah, it comes from that era. But they actually tried to take it one step further and make the cement using desert sand, local desert sand.
Wow.
Apparently it didn't work.
Okay. So,
but other than that, it would have been great. It would have been even better.
Wow. Well, Ed Dobbins is a Phoenix history enthusiast, and thank you so much for telling us about this interesting corner of pottery history.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Crowds have flocked to Sedona for years, drawn by its red rocks, New Age spirituality, spas, and outdoor activities like hiking and biking. But over the past several years, those crowds have led some to complain about overcrowding. Sedona has had problems with housing and homelessness, and city leaders have struggled to get a handle on some of those issues as well. But our next guest says while Sedona may be over-touristed, it's not overrated. Aaron Strout, a freelance writer and author based in Flagstaff, argued in a piece for Outside Magazine that despite the crowd, Sedona is still a worthwhile place to visit. A few weeks ago, I spoke with Strout to discuss it.
Yes, that was the idea of it, was to say, to sort of acknowledge that, yes, it's very crowded there, but it's also worth seeing.
So what to you makes it worth potentially battling the crowds?
I just think, you know, the landscape obviously is beautiful, and it's unlike anything you'll see, especially for somebody like me who came from the East Coast. There's just nothing like it anywhere else. And so I do think, you know, the Red Rock Country is just so gorgeous. It's worth seeing.
What is sort of the prevailing feeling among residents of Sedona about all of these crowds? Like, I'm, you know, you're coming down from Flagstaff, so you're close, but not in the town there. What do people who live and work there say about all these, you know, sort of these somewhat newfound crowds?
Well, I think it's a double-edged sword, which I sort of get into in the piece, because the, you know, town of Sedona obviously relies a lot on tourism dollars. And so it is an important part of the economy there. I do think that, You know, it's very welcoming to visitors, and I think that they embrace visitors, but also want to be cautious of, you know, sustainability and respecting the public land. And, you know, sometimes those kinds of issues get ignored when there's so many people there.
Have you heard from people? I mean, you're obviously in sort of the hiking outdoors world. Have you heard from people who have said to you, you know, I was thinking about going to Sedona, but it's too crowded. I just don't want to do it.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that, especially, you know, living in Flagstaff, you want to pick your times to go down, and we have the ability to do that, fortunately. So I don't think you'll ever catch most of us who are, you know, in the proximity to Sedona going there, just sort of the height of tourism, which to me is, you know, the spring break sort of time frame. I usually don't go down there during that time. But I'm also an early morning person. And so I think any time of year that you can get down there and get on a trail early in the morning, you're going to be okay. And you're not going to run into a lot of people.
One of the things that I found so interesting was when you would talk to friends who have sort of secret places or their favorite places to hike or to eat or something, you would ask them about them, and they would say, I'll tell you, but don't, you know, don't take any photos or don't publish anything. And it kind of sounded like they were maybe kidding, but also maybe not kidding.
Yeah, I would say they're probably more were not kidding. I think people have like their, you know, little hidden gems that they like to visit or where they would like to go get a beer that's maybe off the beaten track. And they don't want to share that in a publication that's reaching, you know, thousands of other people who might make those spots a little bit overcrowded.
Have you heard of that kind of thing happening where, you know, maybe a friend of yours had a favorite hiking trail or a favorite watering hole and then like word got out and they like can't go there anymore?
I haven't yet. I do think that people around here sort of guard those secrets pretty well. So I have not heard of that happening, but I didn't also want to contribute to that in a piece that was reaching a lot of people.
Sure. So one of the other things that you write about that I thought was interesting was this idea of Sedona being sort of a place for a lot of different kinds of people. Like if you're into, you know, certain forms of spirituality, if you're into sort of a new age mentality, if you're into the outdoors, like all these types of people can find something interesting and something to do in this one place, which perhaps makes it not surprising that it is really popular with a lot of people.
Yeah, definitely. I was actually I met somebody. I was really fortunate recently to be able to go over to Europe and do the Tour du Mont Blanc. And along the lines, you know, we ate dinner with lots of different people from all around the world. And I actually sat next to this one woman who, she wasn't from here, but she, you know, was a big hiker and she had visited Sedona. And what she mentioned that she loved about it as a visitor was the fact that she could bring her in-laws who were more into like, you know, the luxury spa vacation, but she and her husband could go out and do hikes that they weren't interested in. So there was just like a little something for everyone to enjoy. And I think a lot of people find that when they go to Sedona.
Yeah. Well, so what specifically draws you to it? Like, what do you find appealing about it?
I think my favorite part is, you know, when it's really dumping snow up here in Flagstaff, you can escape very quickly down to Sedona where it's, you know, you could go on a run in shorts and a t-shirt while it's freezing up here. I think that's my favorite part about Sedona is just kind of escaping the winter up here and going down there and finding a little sunshine on your face and get a little rejuvenation.
Okay, so not to give away any state secrets here, but do you have any tips for people or places to, you know, maybe people who are not super interested in fighting the crowds where they can go and enjoy the beauty or enjoy the outdoors or any of the other stuff that one can do in Sedona and not have to, you know, wait for an hour to do it?
Yeah. I feel like any of the trails that are sort of on the outskirts of town are great. I enjoy the trails that kind of force you to climb up, and a lot of visitors will avoid those because they're a little bit more strenuous. Mm-hmm. And so I would say like Bear Mountain is great. It's strenuous going up, but you'll get rewarded by the views at the top. Mount Wilson, places like that are sort of where I tend to go. just because I like to climb up the mountains and look at everything below.
That is Aaron Straub, a freelance writer and author based in Flagstaff. Aaron, nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Flagstaff author Kevin Fidarko spent the better part of 6 years as an apprentice river guide along the Colorado River in the bottom of the Grand Canyon. He studied the culture of people who are transfixed by the bottom of the canyon and the art of rowing down it. And he wrote a book about it called The Emerald Mile. But his newest book, A Walk at the Park, presented him with an entirely different view of the canyon. Last summer, I spoke with him more about it.
In the summer of 2015, my friend and collaborator, Peter McBride, National Geographic photographer and filmmaker, came to me with a rather harebrained idea. And he said, look, I know that you know the world of the river at the bottom of the canyon, but what we're going to do as an assignment for National Geographic magazine is we're going to strap 55-pound packs on our backs, and we're going to walk through the canyon on foot. We're going to walk along the length of the canyon, starting at Lee's Ferry, ending at the Grand Wash Cliffs. And we're going to do that together, despite the fact that there is no trail that you can follow through Grand Canyon National Park. So that's how the whole thing started. And the misery and the brutality and the suffering that ensued from it was really the dominant theme, at least for the beginning part of the journey that followed.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this has been called the toughest hike in the world. Is that right? Like, I mean, no trail is like an understatement.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say that it is one of, if not the toughest hikes in the world. I mean, it's the second most visited national park in America. It's got 6 million people that come to it each and every year. The only park that receives more visitation is Great Smoky Mountains National Park back east. And most people who go into the canyon and through the canyon, they use the only highway that's really available. It's the Colorado River. It's the instrument that carved and created and polished the canyon in the first place. And a river trip is a wonderful way to experience Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. Colorado River travels about 277 miles as it moves through the bottom of Grand Canyon. But if you are moving through this landscape on foot, you have to keep in mind, this is probably the most shattered, broken, fragmented landscape feature on the face of the North American continent. And you will spend so much time bushwhacking through the backcountry, moving up and down the walls of the canyon to piece together a route along the very thin ledges and terraces that you move across, taking these enormous detours into side canyons, more than 600 of them that you have to thread into and then back out of, that on foot, you're not going to cover 277 miles. You're going to cover about 750 miles.
Wow.
So that is just an incredibly difficult thing to do from a physical standpoint.
Yeah. So you enlisted like a group of more experienced hikers, it sounds like, to let you tag along, at least on the first part of this journey. Talk about how you began, your expectations, the things that you even tried to bring, right?
I mean, I'm embarrassed to say, but there's just no way of getting around it. Pete and I did not prepare adequately for this trip. We assumed that we knew the Grand Canyon by virtue of our familiarity with the river.
Yeah.
We figured, how hard can it really be? And so we were not in the kind of physical shape that we needed to be in to be able to carry these enormous packs up and down the walls of the canyon for 8 or 10 hours a day. We didn't know what to bring in terms of the discipline and the hard choices that you have to make between what you think you want inside of the canyon and what you really need in order to survive. Mm-hmm. The only thing that we did that was a good decision was we convinced a group of very, very experienced long-distance hikers who were embarked on their own continuous through hike to let us tag along for the first part of our first segment. And I have to tell you that, you know, it took the canyon just 5 days to break Pete and I in half. Mm. By that point, the bottoms of my feet were covered in so many blisters, it looked as if I'd been given a pedicure with a belt sander. Oof. Pete had succumbed to a brutal heat condition known as hyponatremia, which arises from a severe deficiency in electrolytes and which, if untreated, can kill you. Mm. And we had to claw our way out of the canyon, abandon this group of hikers that had taken us under their wing, come back to Flagstaff with our tails between our legs, and acknowledge that we had failed, and that if we wanted to complete this journey through the canyon, we were going to have to really restart the whole process and prepare adequately for the venture.
Right. And you write about this pretty brutally in the book, but there's an excerpt I would love for you to read from when you first arrived there, before you kind of realized how terrible this was going to be and what you saw. It was at night. Can you read that for us?
Absolutely. We pulled off the pavement and followed a set of tire tracks leading through clumps of salt brush and rabbit brush, interspersed with the occasional yucca. It was pitch dark when we finally reached the end of the road, killed the headlights, and gasped in awe as we stepped from the truck. The Milky Way shimmered across the heavens from one horizon to the other, and the rest of the sky was speckled with so many constellations that I felt dizzy and was forced to look away, which is when my eye caught the flicker of a small campfire about 20 yards in front of us. Amid the orange glow, I could see the silhouettes of Rich and his crew of hikers set against the star-dappled immensity of the night.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's this immense beauty at the same time that you also really capture. And obviously you love the Grand Canyon. You spent a lot of time there, you know, maybe not in this way, but on the river, right? Talk a little bit about the balance of those two things. Like, were you surprised that this place that you love so much could tear you apart like this?
I was, and you've put your finger on a really salient truth, which is that, you know, to move through this landscape on foot is to experience a kind of unending river of suffering and hardship, but punctuated with moments of extraordinary beauty, revelation, epiphany, insight, wonder, and magic. I mean, there are wonders tucked inside the folds of the canyon that are invisible from the rims where most people go to look into the abyss, and also invisible from the river. And those places are places that very, very few people get to set foot in or lay eyes on. There are places where you find tiny springs bubbling from the rock that are capable of supporting up to 500 times the density of flora and fauna that flourishes in the surrounding desert landscapes. And then, of course, there is the pageantry of light that unfolds each and every day as the sunlight plays along the walls of the canyon, those 26 separate layers of rock arrayed in horizontal strata, each a different color and texture. And the walls can take on, you know, the appearance of a painting by, say, Monet or Van Gogh, depending on what hour of the day and what type of weather you're gazing at them on. It's just a wondrous, magical, extraordinary place that has no analog anywhere on Earth.
Let me ask you lastly, Kevin, about finishing it, right? Like about 750 miles. This took you, you know, more than a year. When you were done, what was your reaction? Like, did you expect to ever make it?
When we were finished, I was immensely relieved. I felt as if nothing could be more difficult or arduous or painful than the physical act of hiking from one end of the canyon to the other. And then I sat down to try and write the book that would tell the story, not just of what happened to us, but the history of the landscape, the history of the native tribes who were part of this park before it became a park, the issues that loom over this landscape and the importance of protecting it as one of the great wonders of this country. And that process, the process of putting all of that down on the page, that took 7 years, and it was far more difficult and painful than the hike itself.
I guess that makes sense. But it's out, and it's lovely. Congratulations on that. And Kevin Fedarko, author of A Walk in the Park, joining us. Thank you so much, Kevin. I really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. When you think of national parks in Arizona, a certain rather grand canyon may come to mind. But Roger Naylor, a longtime Arizona travel writer, says there's a whole lot more out there when it comes to national parks and monuments in our fine state. Naylor's new book, Arizona National Parks and Monuments, offers a companion for anyone willing to explore them. He says it doesn't have to be a massive undertaking, and they each offer a glimpse into a piece of Arizona history. Naylor joined me in November to discuss it.
We actually have 3 full-fledged national parks. We have 19 national monuments, more than any other state. But we also have different types of units. We have national historic sites, national historic trails, national recreation areas, so forth and so on. I explain all the differences. But ultimately, what matters is that these are our special places. Yeah. These are our crown jewels. And they're right here in our backyard. We have 34 of them.
That's a lot.
Yeah, in this state. And I bet a lot of people couldn't name many of them. There are at least a third of them that are within a 2-hour drive of the Valley of the Sun.
Right.
And you can reach virtually every single one of them within a 4-to-5-hour drive. So that's just a lot of adventures waiting for you right there.
Right. And you're also trying to make the point here, right, that it doesn't have to be a massive thing. Like, these are not all backcountry hikes or things that you need to be incredibly experienced with the outdoors to go do.
Exactly. I think there's sometimes that intimidation. Well, it's a national park, so we need some vacation days or a long weekend or what. And you can certainly do that, but there are so many of these that are just great little day hikes, great little simple, easy 2-hour adventures. You know, Montezuma Castle, Toosegoot, Tonto National Monument, and so forth. Those are just, you know, nice, quick, easy little day trips that are perfect to show guests to from out of town that want to see, experience some of our past and scenic beauty. But you can kind of do them in all kinds of different ways, even the big national parks. Just last month, I live in Cottonwood, so I'd get up in the morning, I drove out to the Grand Canyon, I hiked down South Kaibab Trail about 3 miles to Skeleton Point, which is one of my favorite little spots. I've got a nice ledge there I like to sit on, had a snack, hiked back out, drove home.
Wow.
You know, and that, just because
it's a day,
I can.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's just a fun thing. A lot of times one of the things I do when I'm traveling into eastern Arizona is I get off the interstate right there at Petrified Forest.
Yeah.
That's the Painted Desert portion.
Yeah.
And you can, as soon as you enter the park, there's a nice little rim top there, and you hike right down into these beautiful badlands that are colored like blood and peaches. And I like to sit down there. I eat a sandwich. I hike back out, and I continue on my journey.
Yeah.
So that's my lunch hour. Instead of sitting at a restaurant, you know, I sit down there. And I, now that I'm saying it, I kind of realize a lot of my national park visits revolve around eating. But that's okay. We have the world-class picnic spots.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's it's perfectly okay to see these parks however you want to experience them.
One thing that really struck me in reading the book is just the history in this, right? Like, each of these places, especially some of the monuments we've never heard of, right? Like, it's just a little view into a piece of Arizona history that I didn't even know had ever happened, right? So let's talk about some of those favorites of yours, some of those kind of under-the-radar places. What is Pipe Spring National Monument to begin with?
That is a beautiful spot. It's a speck of a park, a tiny little 40-acre park set amidst the Arizona Strip, which is that portion of Arizona cut off by the Colorado River. So it is in the far north section. It is, I think, the most remote place in Arizona that you can reach via paved road.
Okay.
It's paved all the way, and it's a gorgeous drive. You'll fall in love with it, and it tells this incredible story. It's an old Mormon fort built atop a water source in the amidst this vast grasslands, and you learn about the Mormon history, the Paiute history, the cowboy history. This is where the first telegraph to enter Arizona came in from. They thought it was in Utah for many, many years. In fact, the rancher who filed a claim filed in Utah wasn't until many years later they realized it's actually in Arizona.
Huh.
And the fort is all still intact, all these beautiful historic buildings. There's a short hiking trail. And again, it's one of those spots, yeah, a lot of people have never even heard of, but it is so gorgeous to see. And you learn about this entire chapter of our history that's really fascinating.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to talk about one that I've been to, actually, which was Wupatki Pueblo, which is kind of north of Flagstaff around the Sunset Crater area. Really striking place. Again, not big at all and sort of off the beaten path.
It is. Wupatki National Monument and Sunset Crater Volcano National Monument are connected. They're adjoined by one scenic road that travels through them north of Flagstaff off in the grasslands there. And Wupatki, by the way, is about to celebrate its centennial as a national monument. In December, it will be 100 years old as a national monument. But yeah, what makes Wupatki so unique among all our pueblos and so forth. There's so many of them are cliff dwellings. They're tucked away in alcoves or they're kind of in caves that, you know, protected and stuff. And Wapatkis are all freestanding pueblos, and some of them are really distinctive. They rise like red bone ghosts out of this grasslands, and they look like natural formations and stuff, and really striking. And you learn as you travel through, you learn about the reason it exists, because for a very brief period after the eruption of Sunset Crater back around 1085, that led this area to become farmable. And so some of the natives realized that and moved in. The Wapatki Pueblo itself is the largest freestanding pueblo in Arizona. It's more than 100 rooms and stuff. So it really is beautiful. They've got this natural blowhole there.
That's cool. You put your hat on top.
Just you feel this cool blast of air in the summertime coming out at you. It's really nice.
It's really cool. Okay, so we have to talk about one that maybe people have heard of, but it's definitely less traveled than the other massive canyon in Arizona, the Grand Canyon. Let's talk about Canyon de Chelly.
Canyon de Chelly is spectacular, and this is a great one, again, if you have limited time or limited mobility, because you can see it in a couple of different ways. Most people experience it through the rim top drives. There's a north rim drive and a south rim drive with these gorgeous overlooks where you're gazing down into this very pastoral canyon there, where Navajos still live. This is the cradle of life on the Colorado Plateau. People have been living here for 5,000 years. And it's just spectacular to see. So if that's all the time you have or are able to do, then wonderful. If you've got more time, you can go take a guided tour into the inner canyon. You can go by jeep, horseback ride. You can do an overnight stay. You can do hiking trips with a guide. There's all kinds of ways to experience. You get to see these remarkable stone villages that are still there that were built by the ancestors of the Hopi that, you know, remain there. But you also see the inner workings of this gorgeous canyon with its stream and cottonwoods and so forth.
Yeah. Okay. So before I let you go here, tell us, you know, if there's one place that people have not heard of that they should go and see that comes to mind for you, at least right now, because I'm sure you could name many. What would it be?
Fort Bowie National Historic Site. Again, I think that's our least visited of all the park units. It's our only hike-in park. You actually have to hike a mile and a half just to reach the ruins of the old fort. But it tells such incredible stories about, you know, the Arizona frontier. This is where the Apache Wars broke out. You get the whole story of the Bascom Affair that led to 25 years of violence on the Arizona frontier and that led to the creation of the fort. It's a great little spot to visit. Again, just a little snippet out in the middle of nowhere. It's right next to Chiricahua National Monument, which is my personal favorite and which everyone needs to see.
Yeah, another one there. An inspiration for us all, Roger Naylor, our Arizona-based travel writer, author of the new book, Arizona National Parks and Monuments. Roger, thank you so much for coming in, as always. Appreciate it.
Very much my pleasure.
And that'll do it for this New Year's Day edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Happy New Year. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.